This is London. This is London.
The Voice of Russia World Service.
This is the Voice of America, Washington, D.C., signing on.
This is the Dutch World Broadcasting System in Hilversum, Holland, with a relay transmission via Bonaire in the Netherlands and Chile, directed to New Zealand.
This is Radio Prague, Czechoslovakia.
Ici Radio Canada. This is Canada.
Bonjour à vous si vous nous rejoignez sur Radio France Internationale. Il est 5h à Paris.
This is Radio Ukraine International.
This is the English program of Radio Deutsche Welle, Germany's international broadcasting service.
Media Network Plus, produced and presented by Keith Perrell.
Well, hello everyone. It's very nice to have you with us for another edition of the program. Today we start with a little bit of sad news. On November the 23rd, after the transmission of the program, we discovered out through Sheldon Harvey on the Winter SWFS Facebook page that Bill Westenhaver passed away. Who is Bill Westenhaver? Well, this is a name that many of you may know. He was a native of Angola, Indiana, and he moved into Montreal in the late 1960s. He was an avid shortwave listener and a member of CIDX, the Canadian International DX Club, and SpeedX in the United States. He was also one of the co-creators, along with Sheldon Harvey, of the International Radio Report that aired on CKUT in Montreal. After leaving CKUT, he went to Radio Canada International, working in the audience research department, responding to various reception reports around the world and sending out RCI QSLs. This is how Sheldon Harvey began last week's edition of the International Radio Report.
When I started this show, I started it with a person who you will remember, I'm sure, by the name of Bill Westenhaver. And we received some sad news this week that Bill has passed away. Bill was a little bit older than me. He would probably have been around his mid-60s. Many people here in Montreal know him from the various radio club activities, doing this show with me for probably the first 15 or so years, maybe even more, before we stepped aside and Janice and Steve moved in for a number of years. We started the show, and he was a member of CIDX, a member of a couple other radio clubs, SpeedX in particular, one of the big American clubs. And eventually he moved on and started working at Radio Canada International. And that's where a lot of people worldwide heard the name of Bill Westenhaver. He was the guy who signed all your QSL cards that were issued by Radio Canada International. He worked in the audience relations department there. And so, you know, he was the guy. You saw that name on all the cards that came around to you. And So we extend our deepest sympathies to all of Bill's family and friends out there, his co-workers. It was sad news to hear that this week, and we wanted to mention it today on the show. We'll have more details on this later on. It was just earlier this week that I got the news. So really sad to report that, and we hope Bill is in a better place somewhere, and I'm sure all of you will have him in your memories today, listening to the show and hearing this sad news. So all the best to our friend Bill out there. Yeah,
rest in peace, Bill.
Yeah, Bill. So we move onward.
Sheldon Harvey, host and creator of the International Radio Report, doing a small tribute to Bill Westenhaver. When I found out the news, I decided to go into our own archives, and I came across a program that I did way back in the late 80s and early 90s, called Shortwaves. And each week we talked about international broadcasting from a different perspective than that of the International Radio Report. This was just around the time of the Gulf War, and I invited Bill Westenhaver on the show to talk about what kind of news coverage there was on the shortwave dial around the Gulf War. So let's now go back into the archives.
That was Yazoo from the compact disc Upstairs at Eric's, and that was a song, or the track rather, Bring Your Love Down. You are listening to Shortwaves on CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal, 91.7 cable. We started off the program with newsreel from the BBC World Service, and we found out what was going on with Iraq and Kuwait and the American troops and British troops and French troops and all the other troops that are in the Persian Gulf as we speak. I have in the studio Bill Westenhaver from the International Radio Report, which airs Thursdays at 2:30 p.m., who's going to give us a small rundown of stations that we could pick up in this country and listen to, and stations to listen to for a good laugh. Hello, Bill.
I hope you turn on the microphone. it's very interesting to follow all the stations from the Gulf area. I must admit that I better say right off the bat, too, that anybody who used to listen to or would like to think they'd like to listen to Radio Kuwait, you're out of luck, because Radio Kuwait went off the air the day after the invasion. That was on the invasion was on the 2nd of August. Shortly afterwards, the Iraqi troops captured the broadcasting house in Kuwait, and the regular transmissions went off at that point. Technicians out at the transmitter site put on a whole bunch of music tapes with special emergency announcements asking for help from the Gulf Cooperation Council and from the Arab world at large to repulse the Iraqi invasion. But those broadcasts went off the air the day after the invasion. They stayed on for like a little over 24 hours and until the Iraqis captured the transmitter site. Nobody knows quite whether the transmitters in Kuwait are still working or not, but they've not been used, so.
So there's no type of, there's no carrier signal at all then?
No. I must admit, nobody seems to know whether the transmitters are just been turned off once they've been captured, or whether they've been destroyed, or what. Mm-hmm. There's no news coming out about that.
What about domestic broadcasting in Kuwait? Has the whole broadcasting system been turned off, or just the international service?
Pretty much the whole system has been turned off. There are some medium wave stations, which we aren't going to be able to hear here, the AM band stations, where they're running programs coming out of Iraq.
Mm-hmm.
So that was taken over.
Okay, now, what would be, of obviously the BBC is probably the best station to listen to in this type of crisis. I mean,
yeah,
the BBC
definitely.
World Service always does great coverage in situations like this. What about other broadcasters, such as the VOA?
VOA's been doing a lot about it. I've never been a big fan of the VOA. I mean, it was one of my personal prejudices. But I would say, you know, follow their coverage, because the U.S. is one of the important players, perhaps the most important player from on the Western side, other than... And they're going to be... giving you the American point of view on it.
Mm-hmm.
Just about all the major broadcasters are talking a lot about this, so tune into any of them. If you want to hear something from the region, the most easy to hear, and I suppose the most interesting, would be Radio Baghdad itself. They have a two-hour English broadcast every day. It's broadcast twice a day, but there's only really one time you can hear it, and that's the beaming to Europe, which makes it across the Atlantic. In the late afternoon here, from 20 to 22 hours UTC, that's 4 to 6 p.m. Montreal time, on 13660 kilohertz. And it's quite interesting and illuminating, shall we say, to listen to it. It's basically, you know, short feature. It follows Baghdad's format over the years, which is short features, maybe 5 minutes long or so, news, commentaries, press reviews, little feature programs, interspersed with a lot of music. They've been playing a lot of Western music, interestingly enough, the past few days. I don't know whether they're trying to attract a Western audience, but they're playing more Western music nowadays than they were playing a few months ago. And it's kind of interesting to read some significance into the song titles. When they keep playing Peaches and Herbs Reunited, you wonder if that's supposed to actually mean something. Or Gloria Gaynor's I Will Survive, where they're trying to get a sort of a message across to you. Or Jefferson Starship's Nothing's Gonna Stop Us Now. And also they do... They've put on some new feature programs. You're going to hear all these communiques you hear reported
what,
about them.
What about their newscasts? How are they covering the situation? Obviously, they're putting out a lot of propaganda.
Very definitely, yeah.
What is it like?
Because I
heard yesterday on Radio Baghdad, they said there's protests around the world for the Americans getting involved.
It's always the same two or three countries. I mean, it's, you know, the West Bank, mm-hmm. Jordan, that sort of thing.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, it's a very one-sided news broadcast. The most interesting thing about it, actually, is seeing where their slant lies, and also listening to the government communiques mm-hmm. that come out. All these little announcements that you hear about on the BBC have originally been broadcast, are all broadcast on Radio Baghdad.
Mm-hmm. Okay, what about other broadcasters?
From the region, United Arab Emirates is going to be one to watch, too, since U.S. troops have started deploying in the UAE. There are two of the Emirates in the United Arab Emirates have had English broadcasts, but the ones from Abu Dhabi disappeared about a week and a half ago, roughly. So, unfortunately, you can forget them. They used to have 2 hours of English a night.
Mm-hmm.
UAE Radio Dubai, which is another one from Dubai, which is another one of the Emirates, is still around, and they're giving a certain amount of coverage in their newscast. They only have short newscasts of about 10 minutes. But they're giving a certain amount of coverage to what's going on. It's interesting to note that Dubai, the very day of the invasion, didn't mention a single thing about it. I think they were scared stiff, quite frankly. Anyway, I'll run through a couple of frequencies very quickly for UAE. In the mornings, you can hear them at 1330 UTC, that's 930 Montreal time, or 1630 UTC, the newscast, that's 1230 our time. Both of those you can hear on 21605 usually, unless the propagation conditions are poor. The 1330 broadcast you can also try on 17865 kilohertz, which usually isn't quite as good, but it's usually listenable. Mm-hmm. There's an early morning broadcast at 0330, early morning their time, that is, 0330 UTC, which is 1130 PM our time. Several different frequencies. I'd say the best one to try is 13675 kilohertz. Also, they're using 11945, 15400, and 15435, but quality on all of them really is quite variable. What else? Syria is going to be one to watch, too. Damascus has, Radio Damascus has two English broadcasts a day, at 2005 and 2110 UTC. That's 405 and 510 p.m. in real time, 12085 and 15095 kilohertz. And an hour before the first broadcast, they have a broadcast in French, in case you prefer to listen in French. What else?
What other... have there been any international broadcasts? I know RCI, they started broadcasting for 10 minutes in Arabic daily to the Persian Gulf area. Are there any other international broadcasters that have added frequencies as well as languages, and well, not languages, but broadcasts to that part of the world?
A lot of them have. Everybody from the BBC to, believe it or not, Radio Thailand have added broadcasts to the Middle East. I'll run through just a couple of them very, very quickly. We mentioned RCI. RCI had had plans to start Arabic programming eventually, if they could find the money for it. Mm-hmm. But as of last Monday, they started a 10-minute news broadcast in Arabic, which is repeated twice during their Middle East programs in our evening time, which is local morning over in the Middle East. At 0330 UTC, which is 1130 p.m., on 11730, and at 0430 UTC, that's half past midnight Montreal time, on 15275 kilohertz. Both of those frequencies come from transmitters in Austria, but we should be able to hear them here, particularly the 15275.
So we're using the Radio Austria transmitters.
Yeah, because it's close, a lot closer to the target area.
What about Radio Moscow?
I haven't heard much whether they've been adding anything new or not, but the thing is, Moscow has quite extensive services in Arabic already for several hours a day, and I'm not sure they've added anything.
What about the British Forces radio service? Because the last time they broadcast on shortwave was during the Falkland crisis. What about now?
Yeah, they actually just started... British Forces Broadcasting Service is a service that's designed to serve British forces in various points around the world, the Falklands, Germany, Hong Kong, whatever. Anyway, BFBS started for the first time since the Falklands crisis in, 1982? Half-hour programs on shortwave. They're running three of them a day, and they're mainly music dedication programs for the troops out in the Saudi Arabia and the Gulf, you know, so that mum and dad at home in Leicester can send their son John, who's on such and such a ship, you know, his favorite piece of music, sort of thing. And it's you know, just bright, chatty DJ shows for half an hour. They're running three different shows a day, and some of the frequencies can be heard here, not all of them, but some of them. I think your best bet is going to be here the half hour that begins at 0200 UTC, which is 10 p.m. Montreal time. 7125 kilohertz is doing more or less okay. 9640 kilohertz, which is a little harder to hear. And probably the best of the three frequencies is 13745 kilohertz. There are three frequencies used at 0930, and unfortunately I've checked them twice this weekend and I haven't been able to hear any of them. But at 1330 UTC, which is 9:30 in the morning, just after BBC goes off for North America, try 15195, 17695, or 21735 kilohertz. All of them were coming through this morning, but none of them were very strong. Mm-hmm. So you may have a little trouble hearing them.
An archive recording of Bill Weston Haver when he was on a program that I did over 20 years ago called Shortwaves in Montreal. Bill Weston Haver died 2 weeks ago. You're listening to Media Network Plus, coming to you from PCJ Radio International.
The Spectrum Monitor is a monthly electronic magazine covering shortwave, amateur radio, scanning, satellites, Wi-Fi, and vintage radio, which is available for any device capable of opening a PDF file.
Category 105, which is speeded to 22 journals.
Speed 220, Category 105.
The Spectrum Monitor also covers amateur radio satellites, maritime and military monitoring on shortwave, reviews of receivers, scanners, and software used for shortwave, and more. Annual subscriptions for 12 issues is only $24, with individual monthly issues available for $3 each. If you're already a subscriber, you can renew your subscription by clicking on the Sign Up for 2015 button. MasterCard, Visa, Discover, and PayPal are accepted. For more details, visit our website at www.thespectrummonitor.com.
Now, there was a time, if you wanted to get a spokesman from a government department, it was rather easy. If you were media, you just call up and say, look, we want to speak to somebody. But over the last little while, this is becoming more and more difficult. Many public servants don't want to talk to the media anymore. Sandy Logan was the spokesman for the Immigration Department in Australia. And he explains to Richard Ady why this happened.
I think there's an aversion based on the premise that that about which they can speak must only be spoken to their masters, their political masters. Now, that hasn't always been the case. There were times when, in fact, certainly senior public servants, that is, members of the senior executive service, were expected. Just as they were expected to be able to speak to Senate estimates, they were expected to be able to talk to journalists when there was a reason to. Now, that has changed over the years, partly through political manipulation and political interference in terms of managing the message, and partly through, I think, a natural aversion to senior public servants wanting any limelight, fearing that, in fact, limelight could jeopardize their careers.
Right. So back in the day, though, who was good? Who made a practice of being able to talk to the media and brief them, maybe not for attribution, but so that the story was better?
I think the doyen, the king, was a gentleman named Jim Dollymore at the Department of Foreign Affairs before it became the Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade, but he continued on then as well. You very, very rarely saw Jim's name, but you knew that Jim was always available to journalists, and not just press gallery journalists, but all journalists, whether it was a consular matter occurring abroad or a local matter. Jim was always available to provide some context, to explain, to elaborate, but always very carefully without treading into the political realm and doing it very professionally and very objectively.
So when did the change come about that it was less possible? Are we talking about the arrival of a specific government or is it something more over time?
I think it's something more over time. I think you can certainly look back to the coalition's victory in 96 and the reliance much more on staffers within the minister's offices for not only policy advice, but also how to manage the message. And they took the lead far more than had hitherto been the case. And that has developed over time. And I think to some extent, the advent of not only the 24/7 news cycle, but the advent of digital platforms and technology, the internet, has created both a boon for communicators who know how to use it, but it's also been a huge threat to those who fear the message, as it were. And so it's been a combination of both human interference or human management and technology just roaring ahead.
What about Children Overboard, Sandy? Because I've been told that had a big impact at the time, but that it continues to be felt to this day.
I think so, but I think also at the same time I'm reminded of Senate estimates and Senate inquiries into that particular incident when the very professional Angus Houston, now Sir Angus, answered quite honestly about video images and other material that had been sent to the minister's office and what it actually showed, what it illustrated. And the question was put to Angus at the time, so what did the minister say? And I think it was something to the effect, well, I guess I didn't see that video. So to some extent, I think there has been a natural disinclination to speaking forthrightly and not so much dishonestly, but sometimes being economic with the amount of information being provided because of a fear that one's political masters will not be impressed. And whether you can trace it back specifically to Children Overboard, that was certainly a very good example of how the assets that were available to the bureaucracy, in this case through the Australian Defence Force's various assets on the scene, how they provided absolute black and white proof of what had occurred and what had not occurred. But it was not for the bureaucracy at the time through the ADF to correct some of the misimpressions or misunderstandings that had been gained at a ministerial, at a political level.
That was very carefully phrased, Sandy. So what situation do we find ourselves in now? And I know you're out of it. Is it that public servants do not talk to journalists unless that is their job?
Not in so many words, Richard, and it does vary from department to department. Certainly the senior executive service throughout the public service, the Commonwealth Public Service, are expected to be able to manage a conversation, an inquiry, even an interview live or otherwise with a journalist. But usually that will be with the Secretary of the Department's approval. I think where it's very clear when it comes to public servants and their appearance, as it were, in the media is around the need for them to be objective and professional in any interaction they have publicly and to be very mindful of endorsement or promotion or sponsorship, as it were, where they associate themselves or their organization with a particular business or product or service. In my time, in the last decade, it varied from department to department, and you've always had, generally, the Australian Defence Force has been prepared to put someone in a uniform up in front of the cameras and to speak and to answer questions.
Up to a point. Speaking as someone who's been on the other end of those interactions, it wasn't always possible to get actual answers.
I understand that can sometimes be a challenge, and sometimes it may well be because of the operational or the sensitive nature of the story. But that said, the ADF, Department of Human Services, or DSS, with Hank Jongen, has always been a very good operator in terms of responding to the media. I mean, to me, the simple thing here, Richard, is answering the phone in the first instance, or returning a call, and it's establishing relationships with your interlocutors, whether they are journalists or whether they are online writers or even citizen journalists. And if there is an aversion from the top down, that is from the minister down, to that sort of engagement, it really makes it difficult for departments then to operate and explain to the taxpayer how it is they are delivering on the policy of the government of the day. And in my instance, for example, at Immigration, Amanda Vanstone back in 2005 essentially said she'd had a gutful of taking the hits that really should have been aimed at the Immigration Department, but at that time had no spokesperson to speak to the media. And she was very keen to get not only a professional and experienced communications team in that department, but she also wanted to be able to remove herself from the sins, as it were, of the department at the time, and understandably.
So from what you were saying just a moment ago, though, the public service actually loses something if it's not talking to journalists and explaining what it's doing and how it's doing it.
Absolutely. There's no doubt about that. And the sad thing is, and it occurs on both sides of the political spectrum, as it were, there is sometimes a great misunderstanding about what an asset the public service can be and the public service that can explain its activities, how much of an asset that can be.
Maybe both sides of politics have tended to conflate their own interests with those of the government and included the public services as part of that.
When it suits them. And what I think some of our politicians have missed is that we have moved into an age where no one really controls the news agenda. no one really has a complete handle on that. Not only is it all pervasive, not only is it 24/7, but anyone and everyone can contribute to the discussion. And if you choose to absent yourself from the discussion, I think you're really doing yourself, your organization, your staff even, a disservice. One of the great pluses I found in my experience of speaking on behalf of the Immigration Department was that staff finally felt that they were being listened to, that someone was explaining what staff had done. Whether it was right or wrong, there was at least an explanation, as opposed to no explanation and assumptions being jumped to very quickly.
So should the communication pros within the public service be making this case to their bosses?
Yes, and not only should the communications pros be making this case to their bosses, but their bosses should be making this case to their ministers. I understand that ministers do want to be accountable. They do want to own the political messaging. They do and must own the policy. But when it comes to the actual programs that deliver on that policy, to the actual operations, I think there's a missing part of that equation and the public are being sold short.
Sandy, you are going to be nothing but a realist after your time in the government and since. Can you see this change happening in which the public service is, again, more open to the media and the people?
I can. And it's cyclical, Richard. And we've seen that in the last several decades, last two or three decades for that matter, where there certainly was a presence, a very small presence in terms of communications staff within each department. That has expanded over time, partly as a consequence of media contraction, partly as a consequence of so many kids doing communications degrees at universities and looking for jobs. But it's cyclical in the sense that, as in more recent times, as the technology takes over or at least establishes its importance and its priority as a delivery mechanism, as a communications channel, I don't think there'll be a choice for politicians or departmental secretaries. There may be some secretaries who will forever be averse to the idea.
All right, now, before we go, let's take a look at propagation. Here's Glenn Hauser.
Keith from IPS in Australia. The global HF propagation forecast through November 28th is normal at all latitudes. From Space Weather South Africa through November 28th, magnetic conditions unsettled to quiet. Shortwave fadeouts unlikely. MUF unstable. From Met Office UK through November 29th, solar activity predominantly low, with occasional common class flares and a 15% chance of moderate class flares. Geomagnetic activity mostly quiet, with occasional unsettled periods. From FK Yanda in Prague, the geomagnetic field will be quiet on November 27th, 28th, December 9th, and 14th. Quiet to unsettled November 29th, December 10th, 12th, and 13th. Active to disturb November 30th, December 1st, 2nd, 3rd, 7th, and 8th. Quiet to active on December 4th, 5th, 6th, and 15th. Mostly quiet on December 11th. From Natural Resources Canada, the 27-day magnetic activity forecast from November 25th shows the DRX number peaking into the active nanotesla range in the polar and auroral zones on December 1st and 7th. From SWPC in Boulder, geomagnetic field activity is expected to be at unsettled to active levels from December 5th to 12th, with G1 minor storming likely on December 6th and 7th, when ANK indices peak at 25 and 5. The lowest indices of 5 and 2 from November 28th to December 4th. Solar flux 115 November 30th to December 4th, dropping to 100 December 13th to 17th. William Hepburn's VHF, UHF, microwave DX maps call for strong tropospheric ducting around most of Australia all week, along the central U.S. Gulf Coast around Louisiana, November 30th, and also off the west and east coasts of Central South America. Extreme ducting along the coasts of Namibia and South Africa, peaking November 30th and December 1st.
Thanks, Len. That's all we have time for. 73 and 88 to the ladies.